Hi, this is Truls Bowman. Welcome to the Sound Architect Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Sound Architect Podcast. I am your host, Sam Hughes, and today I am joined by Truls Bowman. Thanks for joining me today, Truls. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's 10 at night over here. I like late interviews.
Yes, it's nice and early for me over here in Finland as well. Nice 8 a.m. compared to your 10 p.m. So I'll be here with my coffee ready to go.
Isn't it weird? I'm looking out your window right now and it's dark. And it's dark here in California as well. Only yeah. In Finland are you going to find that.
It's a weird kind of crossover of the same time zone. So you're a man of many talents, okay? You're a composer, sound designer, plus you founded 8DO, and you have a PhD in music technologies as well. So before we dive into your work, I'd love to know how your journey into sound and music began.
I got my first computer when I was 6 years old. It was the ZX Spectrum 48 kilobytes by Lord Sinclair.
Nice.
And that machine had an amazing ability to emit certain sounds, and there are small music programs for it. So I learned something recently about the Spectrum, which is blew my mind. There was a very famous game for the Spectrum called Manic Miner, and they have in the Hall of the Mountain King by Grieg playing. But back then, the computer resources were so small that you could either choose between creating a sound in the computer or generating a graphical frame. So how do you make music and graphics at the same time? Well, what they did was that they would play one frame music, one frame graphic, one frame music in such a fast order that the game has sort of a glitchy sound to it, but that's actually what's going on. It's a brilliant move by whoever that programmer was to even figure out how can we make sound and music, well, one frame of each.
What a gutsy choice as well, like, you know, to actually go, okay, we're having a frame of audio and a frame of visuals after each other.
It's crazy. And it taught me a lot. I went on to the Commodore 64 after that, which was, you know, had a dedicated SID chip in it, which I still think is a magical chip from the old days, which opened up that whole can of musicality in these computers and all that. But I think the strict limitations, even of the Spectrum and the C64, that I only had three voices, really created an enormous creative climate, because when you're that restricted, you really have to think intelligently. So on the Commodore 64, for example, you couldn't play chords because that would use all three voices. So they made arpeggiations running so fast that it kind of sounded like a chord, and that became that sort of C64 aesthetic. And I think it's so beautiful what happened back then. And it really informed me a lot in terms of how I think and what I do, how these old computers were working. And I think it's pretty much shaped who I am musically as well.
Amazing. And yeah, it's phenomenal the restrictions people had to work with. We're spoiled nowadays, aren't we, really? We can do pretty much anything we want now.
Yeah, and therein lies a part of the problem. I'm counter-arguing what I'm doing for a living because we sell instruments and colors. But I think the problem is when it's kind of like a kid that can have everything they want in the world, but thereby they get uninspired because there's no limitations and you can just buy the next piano or the next thing, and it almost restricts your creativity, where I think limiting your options actually creates a better foundation for creativity.
Well, it creates problem solving, right? So problem solving confers creativity.
Yeah, you're right. And under a limited framework, because I still think like some of the thematic stuff from the Commodore 64 by Galway and Hubbard and many others was, even by today's standards, some of the most brilliant compositions made, because they had to be so resourceful. Well, melody comes first. That's got to be catchy. But no room for elaborate orchestration and ornaments and too many synthesizers or whatever we add to our music today. Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, when you have too much choice and too many options, that's when you kind of struggle to decide what to do, right? Sometimes your best work comes out of like limitations or setting yourself restrictions.
Yes. I often think about Beethoven's Fifth. The story goes that it took him 4 years to write it and all the crazy, beautiful modulations in it. But it really is da-da-da-da. A great exercise in restriction as well. You know, learning to temper something simple, but yet create it so beautiful and advanced.
Yeah, definitely. And so how did it go from Spectrum, Sinclair and C64 to where we are today? What was the journey there?
There's a few more steps, but it became...
a couple of steps.
it became the Amiga. And with the Amiga, I started getting the capability to sample for real. I actually sampled in the Spectrum as well. Back then, you had to play the same tape over and over because you were loading via cassettes. And it was slowly built at low, low resolution of whatever that sound was. And the C64 was a little bit better. But the Amiga opened up a whole new realm of 8-bit. It's kind of funny when we talk about video game music, most people think that the world started 8-bit. The Spectrum was a 1-bit computer with a 1-bit sound chip. So there's actually generations before 8-bit as well. But 8-bit was really when it started taking off with Amiga and the ability to sample in 8-bit as well. And that opened up that whole notion of, oh my God, I can sample things. I have this old James Brown groove or whatever, and I can start making music with that. I think the Amiga was such a giant leap, both computationally and musically as well. I opened up a whole new dimension of 8-bit music. The great Diana Sisters was a beautiful one, even though that was on the C64 as well. But the game that really got me on the Amiga was actually Defender of the Crown, which is an old medieval game about saving damsels in distress. It introduced like a new set of graphics, which I thought was photorealistic back then, but clearly not by today's standards. I've actually fallen for that trap a couple of times where I think like, this is realism, and then only to realize it's so not real. But back then, it had some amazing themes, and it was the first game that really sort of captivated me in terms of storytelling. This was back to a company called Cinemaware that created storytelling games. And many years later, there was a remake of the game. And I was super, super excited. This got to be like early 2000s to see that someone had bought Cinemaware and wanted to remake this brand that was long forgotten ever since. And I sent them a demo, and the demo got rejected. I just sent it as a fanboy out of the blue. And they're like, hey, thanks so much, but we already got a composer. And I was like, I really wanted to score it. So I sent another demo, and they were like, who is this like persistent guy that keeps sending demos? And they listened to that one as well. And they said like, hey, so cool. This is actually really great. We would love to use it, but right now it's not really working out. And then a couple of days later, they wrote me accidentally that they had dropped it into a cinematic of the game. And all of a sudden that just worked perfectly. It's complete random luck. And then they were like, oh my God, like this guy is really, and I got to live out my wildest Defender of the Crown dreams and rescored the entire game with all the original themes, but with modern orchestration. Stuff was done in GigaSampler, which was sort of the next evolution in sampling. You know, we went from the ASR10 from old school samplers or hardware samplers into these first like streaming samples. I had a friend in Sweden, his name is Tobias Marburger, who was the first to do hall-based recordings and samples. And these were free for GigaStudio. They're recorded in a church called Grebstad in Malmö, which is a beautiful church. And that meant so much. And his samples was used in the Hulk score and many other places as well. But I used them in the Defender of the Crown, and that really was eye-opening for me because I'd sort of been... I've never really taken music seriously. I should add that as well. I've always had music on the side. My mom told me, whatever I do in life, don't get into the music business. So I did not. So for that reason, I took a variety of academic degrees that are really unrelated to what I do. But I always had music as a hobby on the side. And then that became Defender of the Crown. And then the whole story is sort of just, you know, stone upon stone, one thing built to the next. The guys that were doing Defender of the Crown and Cinemaware moved on. And the main project manager, who's been my biggest mentor in my life, ended up being the GM of a company called Crystal Dynamics that's done the Tomb Raider franchise and many others as well. And when I was a hopeful PhD student, I was studying music systems for video games and artificial intelligence. And at that point, he had another game they're working on called Project Snowblind, which is a sort of cyberpunk game. And after that, they're working on the first sort of major remake of Tomb Raider. Tomb Raider went dark for a couple of years because the brand was sort of on its way down, but Eidos back then wanted to rejuvenate it. So that became Tomb Raider Legend. And as a part of your PhD studies, you have to do abroad studies. And I was so lucky that the university was willing to allow me to go and score over there as a part of my field studies.
Amazing.
I've always pushed the university that, and I still feel this way, that the academic world needs to be in the real world of games and not sit so much on the golden throne of academics. At that time, that was a very lonely voice at the university making those statements. But I think the European universities, it took them a little longer to get industry oriented versus the American ones. But I think today it's a very different and great climate where academia and games can meet.
Yeah.
Anyway, I came over, scored Tomb Raider, and I had all my great PhD ideas. I was like, let's do focus group testing and target group analysis, and let's get the music peer reviewed and as academic as you can be. And I learned a valuable lesson in games is that people working in games do games because they want to work on them. They don't do them because there was a focus group or a target group and this and that. And the more I got into that, the more I learned that like it's passion that is driving these things. So later in life, I did the exact opposite. I created probably the biggest project of my life based on that very notion of forgetting about any kind of academic structure or theory and really try to develop something with my heart instead, which I think is at the core of what all music creation is really about.
Nice. Yeah, definitely. Fantastic that you managed to do that as part of a study as well, like as part of your studying.
Yeah, the university was incredibly sweet. And I owe them so many things back then that they would allow that. You know, get a student into the commercial world and learn from it and then come back with some new thoughts in terms of how we can improve them. You know, it's such a young field. And especially in terms of academia, we don't really even understand what games is quite yet. The best term I've ever heard was fun. That's the greatest theory of all games. That's what it comes down to. But in terms of like all the cognitive aspects and something I actually think is an important discussion as we venture into the world of VR and AR, what is the purpose of these games? Because I don't think we can rightfully call them games in 10 years from now, it's going to be something entirely different and a new form of entertainment that we haven't seen before, which have, I think, great implications for the future evolution of humans, actually.
Yeah, and there's a lot of potential with the future technologies, and I'll definitely love to pick your brains on that when we circle back to it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I quickly want to ask about tackling the Tomb Raider franchise, because you joined for Legend, right? But you also did Anniversary, which is a remake of the original Tomb Raider. And how was it to approach and use Nathan McCree's original music?
It was, I in Legend, I was trying to really be respectful to the legacy of it, which I think is important when you are a commercial composer, and a part of that is really giving people what they want. And when you have a theme that's so thematically baked into people's brains, and it's beautifully simple, you respect it. So in Legend, I played that with a duduk, and then I added ornaments to it as well, and sort of shaped it into a new theme as well. But with Anniversary, I felt like that was all about just paying a full homage to the original game, and just use all the themes and write them, just reorchestrate them with respect to the original franchise.
Thank you. it's a beautiful soundtrack. I mean, I have to say it's one of my favorites for sure.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I can't even remember it anymore.
Yeah, I used
that drum right there. I'm pointing at a hang drum right now. That one.
Oh, nice.
It was right around the time I got it. That was one of the few new additions, plus the orchestration.
Oh, fantastic. And like when approaching composition in general, what is your main philosophy and approach when it comes to writing music? What would you say is your core kind of philosophies there?
For me, I only use my heart and my ear. So I'm not theoretical at all when it comes to music. It's simply, if it works, it works. And the same with composition. If I can achieve a given result in whatever obscure way and it works, then it works. The ear wins over my brain and logic. And every time I try to force something with my brain, let's say I have this amazing theme in my mind, it never works out in reality when I play it. So I'm working with UCLA right now as a professor in a given course around mixing. And the message is the same. I think it's more about psychology than anything, actually. Most composers will, I certainly had, you know, go in with the ambition of wanting to sound like John Williams and then realize that I'm not. and instead focus on the development of the independent voice of whoever I am as an individual. And I think learning to stay true to your voice and what you think is inherently just cool and not trying to work outside your boundaries is the best way. I see many people that say, hey, I can score any genre and any style and all that stuff. And then the more they say that, the more I know that they're not really good in their trade. You got to hone in on what you really rock at. I think a lot of composers, especially right now, are battling a little bit, like being still caught in that sort of John Williams world when the rest of the scoring world has really moved on. It's a conversation I'm actually having every time I score a video game right now, because it's just not about an ego thing for me. It's just about offering the most current kind of trends. And sometimes developers will still be, even as developers, caught a little bit in the John Williams world as well. But if you listen to the majority of soundtracks and today going on, they're far more experimental, sound design-y. I call it musical sound design, where the worlds between music and sound design clash. And the criteria is just so different. But in very short words, man, it's just about scoring with your heart and your ear and let that get your intellect out of the way.
Yeah, and I think that takes time, right? Even when people start out, I guess it's something you learn by doing.
Yeah. And this is where the psychology comes in as well. I'll say I've naively done it in the past. There's been so many times where I had a good musical idea in my intellect and it just didn't come out the right way. And I could blame the samples, I can blame myself. But at the end of the day, all I should have done was to let that thought go and just be with the music. These days, I think a lot about what it is to be inside of the music and outside the music. I tend to, in the past, score very much from the outside. But for me, at least, if I want to make something beautiful, I have to score from the inside. I have to be inside the music, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I want to kind of ask about something you mentioned before that a lot of composers have said in terms of, okay, don't say you can do everything because no one can do everything. Find what you're good at and then just focus on that.
Yep.
Now, what are some of the signs that some composers struggle in finding what they're good at or knowing what they're good at?
There's a great lesson in jazz when you play live or you improvise that if you make a mistake, just keep playing that mistake over and over. So it looks like it was a deliberate kind of thing you're doing.
Yeah.
And it's not even to fake it. It's actually to force another direction for the music. I heard an interview with Dominic Miller the other day when he wrote Sting's Shape of My Heart. And he was practicing his Bach scales, which he's mesmerized by. He made an error and that became that beautiful guitar hook for Shape of My Heart. And I think it's exactly what it's, you know, allow for the mistake, embrace the mistake. And I think really with music, let's say I've seen a lot of people in the past and I've encouraged a lot of people and some of them have really been lucky by embracing this as well, that some of them, for example, came from the EDM world. Junkie XL, for example, came more from that world but was good at embracing that trend and infusing it into what the scoring world needs as well, which is like the orchestra and all that stuff. But being honest with his original voice, hey, I'm an EDM guy doing orchestral. I'm not an orchestrator doing EDM. And I think just being confident in your voice and confident in your sound and then at all times get the ego out of the way. When I say confidence, it's not to be mistaken as like, I need to put my thematic stamp on everything. It's just that my voice, I dare doing this, I dare approaching it this way. And if the client says, hey, this is fucked up, sure. Then I'll talk to the client. I did this both on Transformers and Overwatch, where I said in the beginning, I'll do anything you guys want, but let me just try here on the first round to do a draft of what I think it should be, knowing what's currently going on in the scoring world and all that. And that for me has worked. And I do it with a completely egoless intention just to bring the franchise up to where I think the current sound is at. For example, I used to love John Williams, but I think Raiders of the Lost Ark is a little bit of a comedy right now when I listen to it, not in a bad way, but the nostalgia is wearing off and I can look at it for the music it actually is. It's great for its time, it served its purpose, but a lot of music fades out. Schindler's List, we'll be listening to that many hundreds of years from now. Raiders of the Lost Ark, maybe not so much.
But I think it's a sensible thing to say, like, you know, music is same as film, is of its time, right?
Yeah.
You know, certain things are of their time and they had a purpose and they served a purpose at the time. I will still say that I think I will still be listening to some John Williams tracks in if I could in 100 years. But again,
what would you listen observe, to?
Which one would I listen to?
Yep.
That's a good question. It'd probably be cliche as hell and be Star Wars. Because the soundtrack for Star Wars, I thought was fantastic.
It was fantastic, even though it was a beautiful ripoff of Korn Gold for his 1942. King's Row was the name of it. If you guys ever want to go to YouTube and type in John Williams and Korn Gold, King's Row, and you'll hear the exact same theme, though Williams made it better. There's one where Williams go up, da-da-da-da-da, he went down. And that's a brilliant thing. And it's a great example of the noble art in music of stealing, but refining as well. And that's a fine line. And Williams has walked that incredibly gracefully. Star Wars, obviously many homage to Mars as well. But again, in a graceful and beautiful way. Speaking of Star Wars, I love Goranson's new approach for the Disney shows. I think he's embracing the orchestra, but also infusing completely new elements and thereby elevating the scores and bringing the franchise forward.
And I think that must be a challenge for many composers that get involved with such a known franchise.
Like,
you have to kind of bring it up to date, but also pay homage and respect to the fan base and the nostalgia. But I was going to say, I do agree with you, though, because John Williams' scores are amazing. But if you heard them today with modern movies, it wouldn't fit.
Nope.
You know, like it wouldn't work the same.
Nope.
Because same as everything, it evolves, right? To support the current.
Yeah, and thank God, man. Like the worst thing I can imagine is like a stagnated art form, like a Germany 1939 with old paintings of woods and deer and all. I mean, there's like, we got to move the art forward. That's the only way. And I actually think I'm sometimes surprised that it's not moving faster, in particular in games. I see games as such a unique creative medium. And I've said this on many GDC lectures as well, that I actually feel that music in games is not pushing enough. I would love to see the media be more explosive and the developers to be a little more adventurous in their decision-making.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's something that still has a lot of untapped potential, because working in games, you know, there's a lot of time pressure, there's a lot of feature pressure. So sometimes I feel like the composers are maybe kind of forced to just kind of ship a load of stems over or go, hey, this is our system, can you just give us this content?
Yep.
Whereas there is a lot of potential there if the composer is willing, as well as the audio team, to kind of push the boundaries on the music system.
Yep.
Then there can be a lot of collaborative effort there. But I think with the way the industry works, it's so fast-paced that sometimes that gets put to the wayside, right? And there's still some games that just have the classic exploration music, combat music, back to exploration music.
Yes.
And that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah, very much so. I also think, you know, another thing that can help, which got me into this whole thing about creating my own instruments, is as you develop your own voice as a composer, you know, really try to develop with physical instruments or with synthesizers, but dive in and look for where is your personality, how can you make it shine, what process can you do. For Tomb Raider, for example, you mentioned Anniversary earlier. A lot of that was done with custom samples because I was annoyed with what I had and didn't feel I could express myself the right way. So the little hang drum here, which is actually, it's so cute. There's a in the mansion in Legend, or maybe it's an anniversary as well, but we actually put the hang drum in so you can play it in the video game. That very thing right there.
That's awesome. You're going to have to send me a picture of this now so I can put it below the podcast for people to see.
It was actually really hard to get it back then with the hang drums. You had to go and stay at an artistic retreat in Switzerland for a week to be sort of in honor of the drum. They would not send them. You had to show your willingness to want the instrument by traveling there.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Maybe it goes back to the whole restriction again. There was something cool about that. You know, not everyone could have them. Only those who really, I mean, today they're mass produced by others, by the way, which infuriated the original makers of it. They really wanted it to be a more unique thing that was only for few. You know, in this digital age with copy-paste mentality, that's something beautiful about scarcity.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with something, I mean, this becomes more of a soapbox than anything else. But in terms of a modern society where everything is at your fingertips, it is nice to find something that is quite scarce or quite rare and hard to get.
Yeah, you know, and that's sort of what I want to hear on a score. Something like, wow, like I haven't heard that before. This makes the game feel more unique. Even as a franchise, I think if music just becomes this bad pedal of another ambient element, fine. We've been there a million times. But if the music is doing something, not necessarily something I pick up with my ear, but it just creates a new type of emotion in the game, those are the type of scores I like to see more of in games where like they're daring to push it a little bit. And the developers, they're daring to push it a little bit. I mean, we're looking at the future of entertainment, undoubtedly. Let's start to be creative. Do we have to kill monsters in every single game? Or can we start maturing the media? And can we start maturing the music in that process too?
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned before you've been working on the Overwatch series. Have you been able to bring some of that to that? Because it's quite a modern and technological-based game, because there's quite a lot of high-tech stuff, futuristic things going on. There's obviously different forms of creatures and things. Have you been able to bring some kind of modern approaches to the music to that?
Yeah, the first one was more traditional, and for its time as well. You know, we talk about like what did we need at the time. That was cool. There was sort of what I would say classical epic, which has sort of died a little bit today, at least in my ears. But back then, that was the stuff. So it was very much written in sort of that was hot right now, and it was classical fanfare music, but with a few electronic elements attached to it. Actually, from some of the instruments I created as well, Blizzard used some of the instruments directly in the game as the music, because we create these sort of more elaborate EDM instruments. That was cool. The second one was more an opportunity to really look at it again. Blizzard wanted to preserve all the original thematic material, which I think is great. Just like Tomb Raider as well, like, you know, stay true to the franchise. You don't redo the Star Wars theme unless you create a completely different branch of that franchise. But also, as I told them, felt that we've also moved ahead. Like we needed to give it a more contemporary flavor. So I asked them in the beginning if they would allow me just to try to create new scores based on the original material, but just add, you know, whatever we've learned the last 7-8 years to it. And that became sort of that iteration of the score, more modern, more contemporary, more clean. Something I look a lot for in contemporary scores is synthesizer work, and even epic music needs to be not have too much reverb in it, no distorted elements, but still sound big, but cleaner and more tight sounds. It's harder to do production-wise, but it gives it a more contemporary sound.
Yeah, definitely. And we mentioned John Williams already, but I'm really curious, who are kind of your biggest idols and inspirations in the art of composing music?
Herbie Hancock has definitely been the biggest influence in my life. And John Williams was very close to that as well. But I find Herbie Hancock musically so far reaching. And we talk about someone, you know, that can master everything. I think Herbie Hancock has shown he can master whatever he's touched in his life, like a true musical genius and very, very expression. He has such a wonderful saying. He talks about music as being the reflection of life. And I thought that's so nice. Beautiful. But there are many others. John Williams, when I listened to E.T. the first time, that definitely brought something new that's always stayed with me, and that got me into classical. Hans Zimmer has always been, I think, really pushing the bar and been a great inspiration. I'm so honored that he's been using many of my instruments. A good part of Interstellar was done with my instruments as well. But really a composer that dares to embrace his own voice and push the game. I also have had an arch nemesis my entire professional music life. His name is Thomas Bergersen. He's a composer for a company called Two Steps from Hell, and he has his own brand as well. And Thomas and I have been arch nemesis for two decades, and he's a better composer than I am. And he always pushes the bar, and I'll try to do it as well, and we'll punch back and forth. And I really, really appreciate his musical evolution, but also his desire sometimes to be willing to just listen and have conversations. And we're both learning from that process. That's been super, super cool. But yeah, I'm far reaching, man. It can be anything. I love The Weeknd. I've been listening to The Weeknd for the last couple of years because that's where we're at with contemporary sound. And as someone that builds instruments for a living, I'm primarily curious about where we are now and where we're going to go next. So I spend a lot of time on Top 40 and appreciate most of it for its production values, but also go back in time. And I sometimes wonder to myself if we've stepped a little bit backwards in the art form. Granted, production is a lot better, but you would never do a pre-chorus in a Top 40 song today. You're like, you know, you lead to the chorus as fast as you can, you get that theme burned, and you repeat the same word ideally as many times as well, so you get the thematic stamp. And it's become a little bit like a prefabbed camp kind of consumption, but with beautiful production values. So I'm thinking like, as a little more eccentric composer, perhaps, maybe we can take those modern production values, but tie them into a little more complex type of music and try to advance the art form, but with these newfound production values too.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. The production has really stepped up to a really good quality.
Oh, it's beautiful.
But the songwriting maybe needs some more work in the top 40, at least, you know, in the mainstream. And I hate to sound like the grumpy old man, but, you know, I feel like music can be pushed to be better. You know,
too
much focused on this kind of like you say, quick to the punch, just get it repetitive, get it hooked in people, get people buying it. That's what matters. Whereas there's a lot more potential there. And I'm curious what you think then, if you see where we've come from where we were. So going by where we're at now, what do you think is the potential future of music in that regard?
This is maybe the question I bother myself with the most every single day. There are many angles to that question. We can talk about it at a distribution level. I think the future of music lies in a model where the artists get paid and where it doesn't all go to Spotify or Apple Music. I think we have all the capabilities today technically to create that platform. It may not be NFT-based, but completely independent, and a platform where the artists can actually thrive and live. If we look at the current trajectory of the future of music, if we stay under a Spotify realm where the artists don't get paid, it's very difficult to make it as a young composer, unless you start working for a company and do your thing. But if people would actually, if the majority of the money went to the artist, I think we would see a more thriving music community. So I hope the future of music is one where we're not seeing mega corporations own the streaming services, but where the artists can just do it on their own and create a free, independent, artist-driven platform, something I would love to, and we're a couple of people discussing right now whether we should try to build such a thing. Someone else will eventually, I hope. Technologically speaking, I think we're entering an age now where I'm going to speak a little bit egocentrically just for a few seconds. I decided about 8 years ago to create a new audio format because I didn't feel I have not enough control over the waveforms, and that inhibited me from making better music. So I created a whole new audio format together with a couple of brilliant programmers. And that audio format allows us to take any waveform and not mix it with another waveform, but morph it with another waveform. So you can truly see what happens if you take a glockenspiel and an opera singer and what that would sound like in reality. So that technology is called SoundPaint, and it's something we're really pushing forward. And for example, all instruments, if you make music on your computer and they're samples, they're normally based in what you call velocity layers.
Yeah.
Those don't exist in SoundPaint. You have infinite layers because we're real-time generating the samples out of an existing deep sample pool of samples. So stuff like velocity stuff and CC automation on your computer doesn't exist in that realm. And it's much more liberating and free. What I'm really trying to say is that I think the future of music production lies in more organic tools. If you look at what's been going on the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of people are going back to vintage analog synthesizers because they are more alive. They just sound better than modern ones. They fit a little bit better in the mix too. They're not so dominant. That's another trend that I think is here to stay, that we're going to embrace some of these older instruments because they're just so beautiful. And maybe we forgot about that. So I think the future of music is much more organic, but and making the computer an organic tool. I have my gripes with the computer as a music production tool. For example, when you make music, you make it on a grid. And that has definitely dictated what music has sounded like since the beautiful inception of MIDI, which allowed this in the first place. We can also talk about MIDI because I worked with Dave, the inventor of MIDI, for several years. We created a synthesizer together as well.
Oh, wow.
But when Dave created that beautiful invention, it dictated what music sounded like from ever on. And the problem is, if you look at a real band or an orchestra, their movement and rhythm, they're not statically on a grid. And we lost a little bit of that charm in music, the expression, the dynamic behavior, when everything got perfectly digital and on a grid. So long story short, I think the future of music, at least with a computer as an instrument, is about making a more organic experience that you truly feel. It needs to feel like you're sitting in front of a real instrument that behaves in non-linear ways and is more emotionally compelling.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, I agree completely. And it's amazing that you actually got to work with the inventor of MIDI. That's crazy.
Yeah. I appreciate that journey so much. It's been one of the most important parts of my musical development and also in terms of being this digital luthier or instrument maker, whatever you call it. Dave invented MIDI 40 years ago together with another gentleman in Japan. And that became the de facto standard for all modern production in the computer. And Dave is a brilliant architect. He's made some fantastic synthesizers, the Prophet 5. If you know Phil Collins in the Air Tonight, the synthesizer on that one is the Prophet 5. You know, Pink Floyd, like most major music from that time. And moving forward, a lot of modern synthesizers. But Dave and I were almost neighbors by more or less coincidence. We lived in the same town. And I kept disturbing him over the years and saying, Dave, like, I really think it could be cool to take this sample thing we're doing over here and combine it with all your beautiful analog stuff. And he wasn't so curious in the beginning. He's been in the industry for a long time, and he's not so hot on samples, or at least not back then. But we had enough tequila shots and got drunk enough times to build some kind of mutual trust. So we decided to build two analog synthesizers together, but with a giant sample pool, and see what happens when we run these samples through true analog circuitry. And that was very informative for me in terms of understanding the organic nature of synthesizers and how that can help make samples more organic as well.
Yeah, and did that influence things like, I have to ask about SoundPaint. It sounds incredible. How did the design for things like that come about? Because you mentioned it was like, I wanted a new audio format that, you know, WAV wasn't serving you enough. How did you first come across that? Like, were you just doing something with WAVs and going, look, I need to do more with this. I can't do this.
I'll never forget when it happened. When I turned 40 years old, I had like a midlife crisis, and I really did not know what to do. I sort of stepped out of the commercial composition game. I want to make a couple of commercial compositions a year. I kept thinking, like, I wanted to do something with water. We lived by some vineyards, and I would walk the vineyard every day and just think about what I wanted to do. And the only thing I could think about was water. So that made me kind of depressed, because I thought about that for almost a year. And I didn't know what it meant. I don't know anything about water. Is it water conservation? Is it like oceans? Whatever. And then one night, accidentally, I smoked too much weed, and I was watching a video with the great martial artist Bruce Lee. Where he was talking, such a beautiful interview. You should put it up if anyone wants to see it, because I think it's one of the greatest like quotes. But essentially, he's talking about what the property of water does when you pour it into a cup.
Like when he says, move like water and stuff like
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, water, be my friend or whatever. But when you pour water into a cup, it becomes the cup. When you pour it into a vase, it becomes the vase. And when he said that, all of a sudden it hit me, oh my God, like we need to create a liquid audio format, one that behaves like water. And that was how it started.
Amazing. What an amazing origin as well. And I love the epiphany moment is perfect.
I remember I stood still and I said, like, fuck, like, fuck, like for like a minute straight. I was like, and then the real journey began, because the technology back then, the processing power wasn't quite there. And we did a lot of initial prototyping for years, and couldn't quite figure out the recipe. And then I was lucky enough to meet our current lead programmer. His name is Matt Ingles. He created Soundflower for Mac, if anyone knows that. Fantastic.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
But Matt is a genius and has been in the industry for a long time. So to long story short, to where we started, he's also a very resourceful thinker. And that was very, very important to create something where now where we're generating samples in real time and we're not taxing the computer more than conventional software. That's a very difficult thing to do, and it requires a lot of old school practice working at low level in the code. And Matt has been very instrumental in that process. And I'm eternally grateful, because it's I can only go so deep, but when you work with a true whiz in programming, they can take that thought and really, you know, implement it at low level code. I'll never forget it. It happened the day I became an American citizen, and I was congratulated by Donald Trump, as every citizen was back then, which was totally abstract. When you live in California, everyone boos when that happened. I mean, it's a pre-recorded video. It's not like Trump was there, but Trump actually had to record a video where he congratulated all the new citizens, which must have been very difficult for him. And the entire hall was booing. But right after I came out, after I became a citizen, Matt sent me the first example of this liquid audio format, testing it on a piano to see if we could generate these very, very fluent and more bubbly, lively, infinite amount of dynamic responses. And it turned out we could. So on a MIDI 2.0 controller today, you actually have 66,000 different samples per key now, which gives it a lot more, gets it a lot closer to the piano. I used to look at my grand piano as this ancient relic. You know, it can only play this one note you go up to, and that's about it, you know, and it's very primitive. It doesn't have a pitch bender or, you know, any controllers on it. It's like it's been sitting there for, you know, it's 400 years of slow evolution. And over time, I learned that I was completely wrong. It's actually the opposite way. It's 400 years of perfect evolution. And when I go up and I click the sustain pedal and all the magical notes start bleeding into each other, I hear a harmonic type of reverb that's better than anything we can even build in terms of analog or digital. The keys are infinitely responsive. There's no load time. There's no boot screen. There's nothing getting in the way from me creating music. I'm just right there with the instrument. And for me, that's what we want to push the computer to be: organic and alive, immediate and instant. And that's really the essence of sound pain, is just to get us back to what it's really about, which is to make music, not sit and move sliders or try to be engineers with 10,000 microphone positions, all the shit we've done in the past, but let's get back to what it's about. The immediate thing of sitting in front of an instrument and really get the computer out of the way. So I don't have to think about the damn grid on my quantization. I can just make music in the fastest way possible. So sound pain was, when we designed it, purely based on the shortest distance between a thought and a creation. So every time there's any action in SoundPaint, we would just sit and count how many mouse clicks is it to do it, and then discuss the process of optimization, which actually ties back to what I said in the beginning, when the whole academic thing about like target group analysis and, you know, making video games with your passion. SoundPaint was exactly that. It was me learning through my PhD studies that all that stuff was bullshit. It may apply great in other industries, but when it comes to the creative field, we have to build with our heart, just like when we make music. And even when we make software, make it with heart as well and in positive intention. It really makes a tangible difference.
And how do you retain that focus? Because when you look at technology, and there's a lot of pressure out there to learn so many different forms of technology, be good at so many different plugins and use loads of plugins, how do you maintain that you're like, no, I need to remember that I'm kind of writing with the heart, even though I'm creating it with technology, I need to keep that in the back of my mind.
The computer has an issue. I call it a translation issue. And that is, if you, for the purpose of sampling, record something, you might think it's cool in the session. And when you get it back on the computer, it's a little bit dead. You just don't feel it. You know, how many times have you loaded some kind of string bank, emotional strings, and it just doesn't feel right? The reason it doesn't feel right was that when it was recorded, it didn't feel right for the players, because they're sitting and mathematically playing one note at a time, not really playing music, and thereby being uninspired. And you are now playing that uninspired sound. So there's a translation issue in the recording process, in all the editing and processing and getting all that down the computer. So I think when it comes to the focus, it's in part to retain that the emotion in the sessions, which is a really tricky thing, which actually relates more to psychology than it relates to music, in terms of making people feel good, set up the candles, let's get a little bit drunk, let's smoke some weed, whatever it is, like to get to that sort of vibe where we're having fun, organize the sessions so they're inspiring, that reads through the samples, and then build the technology that can carry all that as well. So you can facilitate that expression, technologically speaking. So it's back to making the computer organic, and a way of doing that is to create things as they actually are. I'm not the biggest proponent for physical modeling for the very same reason. We've now chopped the sound up so many times, and while it may feel perfect on the keys, it doesn't really respond to me as a human being. The vibrato is synthetic. I'm not really there as a human. So I'm much more on the acoustic, like, let's make it feel real. Like when we do vintage synthesizers and sound paint, like, they are ultra deep samples. So it's not kind of like being there. It's totally like being there. I'm looking to my right now at an 808 drum machine, an original one, which I regard as one of the greatest instruments ever made. It has 16 sounds on it. And in sound paint, it was over 15,000 samples. The clap alone was sampled over 1,000 times to teach the engine why is it so different every time? What is it that goes on in the analog world when something keeps repeating itself, but it sounds, it's good to the ear. It's not the same thing because these machines are inherently musical. So that's where my focus is at, on beautiful sounds, making sure a waveform is as pretty as it can be, and then Frankenstein that up in the software and hopefully make it alive in the process.
Wonderful. So you're basically trying to keep that emotional side as well and what makes it alive, rather than remove all life from it, make it a sample library, and then people have to put life back into it in post-production.
You know, Dave had a wonderful saying. He's like, he always had out for the term workstations, you know, like a workbench. It shouldn't be a workbench. You know, it needs to be more than that. And I think when it comes to these things, it is the notion of making these things alive, you know, that the human experience, back to Herbie Hancock again.
Yeah, and it's what not only what drives us passion-wise and everything, but it's also what resonates with us, I think. Like,
yeah.
When there's an element of life to music or art or anything,
yeah,
then
exactly.
We relate more.
Yeah. I always say it's like perfect imperfection. And even when I word the imperfection, I'll put that in parentheses because it's that's really what it's about. You know, a great drummer is not perfectly on the grid. He's anything but that. But a great drum machine is perfectly on the grid doing its thing. And, you know, the groove is inherently imperfect, and that's what makes it so beautiful and delicious.
Yeah, and it's like you were saying earlier, it's those mistakes, those beautiful accidents that make life real, you know, that makes it more alive and brings the music into a more personal kind of area. Like when you go to a live gig and someone makes a mistake, it's a beautiful thing because now you're like, only I got to experience this,
yeah.
And the other people in this room with me.
Yeah.
So it's always something special. And so sound paint sounds amazing. And how did 8DO begin? Like, is this what, 2011, I think you founded?
Something like that, yeah. 8DO was, I had a previous company called Tonehammer with two guys that worked on Tomb Raider as well. So I started building my own instruments for Tomb Raider. And then later on, we were like, hey, we're a couple of guys thinking like, hey, it might be fun to like try to sell these sounds and put them online because who knows, like I've sort of used them now. And we did that, and that turned out really cool. And we did that a couple of years, and then we had some sort of creative differences. So the guys made another company called Soundiron, and I made 8DO. So I was still building the tools, but now I was just building more with commercial intentions. So the two sort of started going hand in hand. And then over time, it just sort of took over. And today, we probably have like the largest catalog for deep sample contact instruments. I came up with this term called deep sampling. It was based on the Deepwater Horizon scandal in Texas, which is this oil spill. And I thought, oh, Deepwater sounded cool, but like deep sample just means we go really, really deep in the sampling process. We have a string library that's over 350,000 samples to make sure we get strings somewhat right.
Oh, wow.
And we can go much further than there. I think artificial intelligence is also something that's on the very near horizon in terms of music production. We haven't really gotten into that, but that's maybe the next biggest frontier.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very exciting time to be alive with all the different AI synthesis that's going on, both with voice and speech, and then in music as well. Like, there's going to be such leaps and bounds in what we can do and the potential of writing music in the next even 5 to 10 years, I think.
There are. My only hesitation is that there's been a lot of attempts at compositional AIs, and I don't think that's going to work out in the near future. And the reason is that if an AI doesn't understand what expression is and emotion and the things we talked about today, it won't really be able to make great music. So we can sit and analyze Bach progressions all day long, but there's a lot more to it than that. And it's kind of like, that's the problem. We need to go down to the lowest DNA level, which is the waveform, and then build upwards. So my whole philosophy is really to build inside out. Elon Musk actually inspired that for Sam Payne as well. He talked about building the Tesla from the inside out, not from the outside in. So you don't make it pretty and then figure out what's in the inside. You really build the core first and then you build outwards. And I think the same thing in the ladder of AI, we got to start with the fundamentals, which is the waveform becoming instruments. Once we have that level of expression in the technology, then we can start building upwards. Easier said than done.
Of course, yeah. But I have to say, I wouldn't be that surprised if an AI was able to generate something similar to what's in the top 40, shall we say.
Oh, man. You know, it's interesting that there's a wonderful analogy for any of your listeners that are interested in AI. An average chess computer today, not a supercomputer or anything, but an average chess AI will render about 100,000 games a second. Meaning that it goes through the history of 100,000 chess games to match what is the best move I can make against your move. So that's like asking you to think about 100,000 chess games and then deem what's the right move. There's no competition. And when we saw the champion in Go, it was actually interesting. He was the champion for many, many years in Go, which is the most advanced board game in the world with more moves than there are stars in the universe. And an AI beat him completely, and he actually never played Go since. He thought it was so infuriating that a computer beat him, so he decided to just never play Go again.
Oh, wow.
That AI then beat itself 100 times in a row through self-optimization, and they did that again, and then they stopped the project because it was getting pointless.
It was becoming Skynet.
there's no competition once we get into it, and I think that's one of the very interesting aspects. I'm personally more curious about... if you talk about the philosophical aspects about the dawn of AGI, which is artificial general intelligence, what happens once we start correlating multiple AIs together? Self-driving cars, obviously being one of the first ones where it could start recognizing its environment and react to it. It's beautiful, very interesting to see the dawn of what might be a form of digital consciousness, if you will, though we don't know what consciousness is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the age-old question, and it's been in sci-fi books and movies and everything for God knows how long, right? We're trying to get to that point, and we're getting scarily close all the time, especially with like what Google DeepMind and things like that, and like all the robots and AI that are being used to emulate human emotions.
Yep.
We can emulate them, but I still think we're a long way off generating natural emotion.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And a good example of that is the evolution of speech synthesis, though they are getting better. And some of the newer ones I heard last year could start reacting emotionally as well. I used to work with speech synthesis at the university, and especially in terms of emotion. So learning emotional intonation, which can somewhat be generated. But even stuff like breathing, you know, they don't breathe.
Yeah.
They don't snort. They don't make mistakes.
Or cough.
Right. All that stuff. Or laugh. You know, a lot of those non-tonal sounds, and that goes exactly for music instruments as well. When you play the guitar, you could sample it perfectly, but if you don't have all the little fret noises and the mistakes, I mean, think about a violin. When you play vibrato on even the best players in the world, the reason they play vibrato on the violin is that they don't know where they are pitch-wise, because the margin for error is so tight on the highest notes that became an aesthetic on its own, sort of being like, because I don't really know what I'm doing. Though they are.
It's around here.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the beauty. That's the imperfection. That's my Danish going bleeding into my American accent right now. You know, that's the, all that stuff.
Now, sadly, I am drawing to what is my final couple of questions. I could talk for days about these topics, but I would love to ask you, out of all the projects you've worked on over the years, what would you say is the or some of the biggest lessons or triumphs that you've had, or challenges?
I mean, Sam Payne, without a doubt, has been the biggest challenge of my life. My wife, Tanya, who's the CEO of the company, refers to it as my life's work, which... it's strange to me because I regard myself still relatively young. But I also know I would not be doing, I would not do it again. I've learned so much. When you really boil down and you break the music down, I don't refer to myself as a composer. I always say I'm a decomposer. breaking the music down in its smallest elements and then breaking those elements down. And I'm at a point now where I'm almost enjoying listening to an old vintage Model D, just a single oscillator, more than I'm enjoying music. Michelle Moog described her dad, Bob Moog, who invented the Moog Model D, the greatest synthesizer of all time, in my opinion, that he could hear the electron pass through the circuitry. And that was what he was attracted to. And I'm really there as well, like down to that low level DNA form. But, you know, to learn to think about these things and break music down has been very, very difficult, and understand all the technical aspects as well. I'm not particularly super deep technical, but that has been the challenge of my life so far. In terms of commercial projects, I think Defender of the Crown, the very first game I worked on, was probably the one, because it was so much about battling, really wanting something and being denied. And I've seen so many people come and go in the industry because it was just too hard. And it is a rough, rough industry. So how to build that mental stamina and stay in the game. It's not so hard to do one thing successfully, but it's really difficult to do year after year after year. Yeah. That takes a whole other mindset. And often by my friends referred to as being OCD. I've concluded over the years that it's not a disorder to be obsessive and compulsive. In fact, it's the only thing that really moves the needle. And for anyone I know in the industry that are faring well, I want to respectfully say that they all have that in common. It's really like, you know, John Williams, I saw a wonderful interview, a recent interview with John Williams, where he said, like, you know, this is not like a full-time thing. This is an all-the-time kind of thing. And that's the horrible truth about what we do.
And I think that's what happens when it's born from passion, right? We can't help it. So although we try not to overwork, we try not to do too much, and we try not to invest too much of ourselves in it. But when we're doing something in that sort of field, you can't help it when you're passionate about something to always even be thinking about it.
Yeah.
You can't stop the thoughts. Like, you know, you can't go, I'm off the clock, stop thinking about audio and music. There are two sides though, right? There is always the balance. Like, you don't have to fully sacrifice all your friends and family. There is a way to involve them.
You're right. And I know at the end of the day, your argument is the winning one, because what you're advocating for is the mental health in it. This industry is not healthy unless we take care of ourselves in the process. For me, I think really allowing oneself to go deep in it and make that sacrifice, which will inevitably, you know, include your surroundings as well, it's a choice every composer has to make at some point when they really get serious about it. But I also really want to embrace your point, because I think one thing we don't discuss often enough is like, well, there is a balance. There can be a balance. It doesn't, not, in my case, not always. And I've paid the price for that in many ways as well. But to look forward and focus on our mental health and our physical health as well, you know, it's a good thing for composers to exercise.
Oh yeah, definitely. You don't want to live in your studio forever. But yeah, I think it's an interesting topic to discuss though, especially with the way that the industry's changed over the years. There's definitely still a lot of that workaholic kind of mentality going around. But then there's also, you can't really argue with people who want to pursue their passion to an extent where they're like, do you know what? I want to spend my evening designing a synthesizer. I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm not going to stop just because someone says it's better for me. I want to do it. Like,
yeah,
and that's going to happen still anyway, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
people are still going to do that. I think the only expectation shouldn't be in a professional or a commercial environment. People shouldn't expect you to work 14 plus hours a day to deliver a project. But if you're doing something on your own time and you want to invest yourself in it, then that's a different story, right?
It is. I'm laughing because, like, I'm thinking about the previous statement about OCD, and I'm always battling it because, you know, in many ways what you're saying, you're saying the right thing. The goal should be to strive for that. And I think as we get older, at least in my own case, I'm starting to take that more serious. But Lord, man, it took me many years to remotely even understand what that meant.
But for someone like you who's been in the industry so long as well, it must be difficult to see those shifts in mentality, because there are still companies and still work practices that encourage this, like, yes, stay all night to mix the game, or stay all night to finish mixing the movie. Do you know what I mean? Like, there is just like, we need to make this happen.
Man.
So everyone just put the hours in, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think on Tomb Raider Legend, for example, I think I had 9 months to do the score, which is just perfect. You know, that's like a level a month or something. And I have good amount of time to explore and mature my themes and all that stuff. And I don't think the industry has, especially to some of the larger entities, like this thing about forcing your workforce and crunch for the sake of crunching because some stupid CEO wants a deadline, whatever. I used to look at that differently because I was very much in the commercial side of games. But now the more I've sort of built my own stuff, the more like we have to build with our heart. And ultimately, it doesn't always pan out. But when it does, you get a superior product. And there's no way around that. And that takes time, but it also takes a form of mental health commitment at a development level. You got to think about the people around you and take care of them and make sure they're inspired in the process so they don't lose that initial spark. It's called talent retention in HR terms, but I think it's much more than that. It's actually just giving a shit about the people you're with and caring for your team.
100%. Yeah. And I think that's definitely a core part that should be among many any people that expect creativity from their kind of team. They need to understand that that's a part of that.
Yeah. And with the whole sort of us slowly coming out of the pandemic, I don't want to discount what the pandemic has done as well. There's many empty offices here in San Francisco, but I think there's going to be a point where people will want to come together again physically as human beings. The discussions, the foosball table, you know, all that stuff. We need that. Like this online shit is not, you know, and it's funny, my company has always been virtual, but I'm actually miss being around other people and talking and sparring creatively and all that stuff.
It's part of the best way to inspire and also just connect. Like I miss it so much.
Yeah.
Very so fortunate here in Finland that the restrictions were never super heavy. Like there was no hardcore lockdown. But still, you know, it's all the little things, all the little moments. And I super miss events. Mm. Like I miss going to events and speaking to other creatives and other audio folks and people outside of audio as well. Like, you know, it's more of a reason to be in a position to talk to them. You know, it's weirder to just be like, okay, I'm going to randomly message a load of people online because I miss talking to people, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very different stage.
It is.
And I'm really, really looking forward to hopefully the near future where that comes back and with a vengeance. I think there's going to be a ton of events. There's going to be a ton of regroups. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on eventually.
Do you hear that sound? Can you hear it? It's the sound of the new roaring 20s. It's still far away, but it has a big thunderous quality to it. I think as we migrate out of the pandemic into the endemic and with the dawn of upcoming AR, MR, VR technologies, I think we're about to see a whole other new dimension of entertainment. We might think the cell phone was impactful. That's a little screen in our hands. What happens once that gets in front of our eyes? I think we're about to see an explosion creatively once we overcome some technological humps and come out of this pandemic as well. That's the new roaring 20s, in my opinion.
Wow, yeah, and I agree. And I think that's a fantastic note to leave this on as well. And I have to say, Charles, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you for your time. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
Oh, absolutely. And forgive me for talking too much. I would love to listen more introspectively to your questions. I get so excited. So forgive me if I got carried away a couple of times.
Oh, no apology necessary. We love the excitement and feel free to ramble on as much as possible. People are here to listen to you.
You're very sweet. Thank you so much. Appreciate it, man.
And I'd like to thank you all for listening. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. This is Sam. Thanks for listening to the Sound Architect podcast. And I really hope you enjoyed listening to that episode. If so, there are many ways you can show your support for the show. Whether it be financially on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/sounddesignuk, or whether you're just getting in touch on social media, we love to hear from our listeners. What's your favorite episode? Who would you like us to speak to? Just let us know. You can pretty much find us anywhere on the internet, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or anywhere else. And until then, catch you on the next episode.